Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, February 8th, 2016. I was looking for a song about New Hampshire, so I went to Spotify and entered New Hampshire in the search window and found this really cool tune from Sonic Youth back in 2004. It's called New Hampshire, and the lyrics make only one reference to New Hampshire boys. Check it out. It's a pretty cool groove. And in New Hampshire, which is hunkering down for a snowstorm, which may coincide with primary elections, the first in the nation, on Tuesday, well, the snowstorm is being preceded by shitstorms from both political parties. We'll get to the Republicans in a moment. But first, I have to tell you that on Sunday I was watching the Super Bowl, a rare concession for me to donate any time to the NFL. And after I sat through that commercial about opioid constipation, and I'm not making fun of people with that condition, just the commercial was really pretty gruesome to watch. And of course, it does highlight that we have many NFL fans who are hooked on prescription drugs. It's a very serious problem, and I'm glad to see that Republicans in particular are not demonizing heroin users who started off with OxyContin or another prescription opioid. But during the game, a friend of mine who is volunteering in New Hampshire for the Clinton for President campaign sent me an email. And she pasted into the email a screed that I traced down to a website called Liberal as Fuck. And it's a blog operated by a person who is described as Joshua Brennig. But when you click on more information, you get none. So I have no idea who Joshua is. And in November of last year, he posted a lengthy screed about Bernie Sanders called Bernie's Baggage. And my friend, the campaign volunteer, sent it to me and said, "Do you know all this? How can someone be the leader of the Western world with such a thin bio? I share your interest and passion for progressive causes, but don't you think the Republicans are going to tear him apart? I didn't know anything about his background other than he wasn't a very accomplished senator." This info sure gives me pause. Well, this is a compilation of all of the negative opposition research that Republicans and Democrats have done on one Senator Bernie Sanders. And some of it is true. Bernie was kind of a loser until he reached the age of 40 and got elected mayor of Burlington, Vermont. And he had a child out of wedlock. This article even dredged up information about Bernie's dad, a high school dropout who tormented his family with rants about their financial problems. And this screed is riddled with right-wing talking points, attacking Bernie Sanders because he visited the Soviet Union on his honeymoon, and he has expressed interest and curiosity in communist and socialist systems of government. He didn't go to Russia to join the Communist Party or support Brezhnev. But that's the way they make it sound. And then whoever wrote this also attacked him for being an activist at the University of Chicago in the 1960s, demanding that the regulations that ban students from having sex in the dorms be lifted. And this article falsely states that this was before birth control and abortion were legal, when there were still various serious repercussions for women if the condom broke. But that didn't stop him from crusading against those silly rules that were an obstacle to his own satisfaction. Now, put another way, this was the earliest expression of feminism on the part of Bernie Sanders, who was campaigning for equal rights for women, an end to the shame of having sex before marriage. And yet, this is written on behalf of the Clinton campaign, really a lowball attack on Bernie Sanders. Then they say he was a draft dodger, And he dodged the draft further by having a kid out of wedlock in 1969 with his girlfriend, Susan Mott. Now, let's keep in mind that we have a sitting president who was born out of wedlock. And I've been surprised that even in the most disgusting attacks on Barack Obama, no one has publicly called him a bastard. But this cesspool writing tries to dredge up that idea. Then it reads that Bernie and his new wife visited the pro-Soviet Sandinista government in Nicaragua, known for their human rights violations, support for anti-American terrorists, and the imprisonment of and exile of opponents. Now, these are Reagan perspectives. No self-respecting Democrat, progressive, liberal in this country would view the Sandinistas the way this is described. And then it goes on to glide over his electoral success, that he won 3 or 4 terms in the House of Representatives from Vermont before he was elected to the U.S. Senate. And they suggest for all of his years... Oh, here it is. Eventually, he won a Senate seat, which he has managed to keep off and on. Well, no. Since he was elected to the Senate, he's been reelected. There has been no gap. He didn't take time off. So the summary is, he's a draft-dodging, deadbeat dad, a globe-trotting communist dilettante, and a petulant detractor of hard-working, honorable Democrats. And this is the kind of desperate mudslinging that the Clinton campaign has resorted to in the last few hours before voters go to the polls in New Hampshire. And I wrote back to my friend and said, look, I like you, but this is really disgusting. I am shocked and disappointed that you'd circulate this kind of propaganda. An Oppo research dump spun up with conservative invective. It reads like a David Brock hit piece, similar to what he wrote against the Clintons in the 90s. This is at the level of the Swift voters of 04, attacking your opponent on his perceived strengths. And I said, really, to mention Bernie's parents and the angry commie dad and frame him as a commie curious guy, this is an attack line that will thrill a few 70-year-old Reagan Democrats but is seen as positive by many Democratic voters under 50. I continued, in hitting the send button on the slime file, your side looks desperate to rough up the upstart old man with this shit, and the recent outrage over who is progressive. Clinton should run as the practical moderate. That's where her voters are. With her superdelegate advantage and prospects in the South, she doesn't need to destroy Sanders to win. And if she expects to win the nomination, she'll need the Sanders wing to get her huge baggage over the finish line. So let me recap that this screed from Liberal as Fuck, a blog, is headlined Bernie's Baggage. And this is the Karl Rove-style projection and deflection that we have seen time and again. You take your biggest weakness and you project it on your opponent. Arguably, Bernie Sanders' ethics and his character are the reason many people, including young women, are attracted to him as a candidate. And that's what the Clintons are attacking. And as I pointed out in my Friday podcast after the debate on Thursday night, Hillary Clinton just ran circles around Bernie Sanders on foreign policy. They don't need to attack his ancient history. After all, do they want all the stuff from the 90s dredged up? Whitewater and white, you know, Hillary served on the board of Walmart. There's a lot of baggage that Hillary carries. And to try to shift the focus and suggest that it's Sanders with the baggage problem, it shows how clueless and desperate and out of touch the Clinton campaign has become. Next item, they trotted out Gloria Steinem and Madeleine Albright, the first woman Secretary of State, to stump for Hillary in New Hampshire on Saturday. And Steinem had been on the Bill Maher HBO show. I watched it on Friday night, and she put her foot in her mouth. As a staunch feminist, She told Bill Maher, well, you know, the reason that women aren't supporting Hillary, the younger ones, is when you're young, you're thinking, where are the boys? The boys are with Bernie. And Maher said, oh, now if I said that, they're for Bernie because that's where the boys are, you'd swat me. And then Albright repeated a comment that she has made in other settings, where she, first of all, dissed Sanders indirectly by saying that if Hillary is the first female commander-in-chief, that would be a true revolution, unlike whatever it is they think Bernie is talking about. And then she went on, we can tell our story of how we climbed the ladder, and a lot of you younger women think it's done. It's not done. There is a special place in hell for women who don't help each other. And so this is so off-key to get these older women to try to shame younger women who don't know who Gloria Steinem and Madeleine Albright are, really. And I'm just so sad to see the Clinton campaign descend to these levels. And as I mentioned, after the big New Hampshire victory tomorrow night for Sanders, who cares what the point total or the margin will be, he faces a really tough set of primaries as he heads to the South. And if the Clinton campaign wants to show the difference between the candidates, they should focus on foreign policy. That's Bernie's biggest weakness. Now, I don't support Hillary just because she's strong. She's wrong and strong, one of Bill's favorite old phrases. But as a political observer, I can see that she clearly exhibits more comfort and experience with foreign policy than Sanders has so far. So Bill Clinton went on in attack dog mode over the weekend, attack dog mode, dressed in a flannel shirt and blue jeans, trying to emphasize his proletarian roots. Clinton really went after Bernie Sanders, even broke one of his own rules and mentioned Sanders by name at one point. He described Sanders as hypocritical, dishonest, hermetically sealed. He claims that the Sanders campaign is a group of people who says anybody who doesn't agree with me is a tool of the establishment. Criticizing the health care plan, he said, is it good for America? I don't think so. Is it good for New Hampshire? I don't think so. So Bill Clinton, who risked a lot of his political capital early in his first term in the 90s to try to pass Hillary's health care reform and failed, is going to tell us that we ought to sit down and shut up because single payer is not achievable and it wouldn't be good for us. And he knows better. And then they go after the unnamed Sanders supporters, and I'm sure there are some who've made sexist remarks and ugly comments that no one would approve of. He said that some of them are too profane, not to mention sexist, to repeat. Well, that goes on in all campaigns. And Bernie's made it clear he doesn't support that, but that's not going to stop some people from doing it. And then mentioning Sanders, he said Bernie took what they said was good about him and put it in his own endorsements. Now, this has happened twice, where in Des Moines and in New Hampshire, newspapers that have endorsed Hillary Clinton also said positive things in those same endorsement editorials about Bernie Sanders. And like a movie promotion, he lifted the line that's good for him and used it. Now, it's kind of a wobbler. He's not implying, he doesn't state that these papers endorsed him. He just said, this is what they said about me. And so this is just another cheap shot from the Clintons who know how to take one. And Bill Clinton did all this in a half-empty gymnasium with only a handful of reporters who had showed up. And so it's really interesting to see, as the national poll numbers show Bernie Sanders surging into a statistical tie with his opponent, that this is how the Clintons respond. And Maureen Dowd in Sunday's New York Times takes a pretty sharp aim. A couple of quotes here. Now she, Hillary's, running against a grumpy Gramps, a stooped socialist with a narrow message, brusque manner, and shaky grasp of world affairs. But the Clintons are still leveling the same charges, as they did against Obama, she's saying, that her opponent's stances are fairy tales and that his idealism masks tough tactics. Another poll here from Maureen Dowd. While Hillary was giving three speeches to Goldman Sachs for $675,000, her party was changing. As the economy slowly healed, Democrats were seething with anger over the big banks that never got punished for wrecking the economy and the reckless billionaires who are still living large. A tone-deaf Hillary was there sucking at the teat, and that rubs people the wrong way. When Anderson Cooper asked why Hillary had taken the obscene Goldman Sachs windfall, she gave a stupefyingly bad answer to a predictable question. "Well, I don't know," she said, throwing up her hands and shrugging. "That's what they offered." She was reluctant to release the text of her "Don't worry, I'm one of you" speeches. As with the email server, Hillary is not sorry she did it. She's only sorry people are making a fuss about it. And one more from Dowd. When Hillary accused Sanders during the debate of doing an artful smear on her, charging him with insinuating that she engaged in pay-for-play with Wall Street, drug companies, and other special interests, some Republicans predicted that the moment would go down as a Gary Hart-style challenge that would come back to haunt her. And let me just inject a few facts here about the money that Bill and Hillary Clinton have collected since they left the White House. In total, the two have given 729 speeches that earned them a combined $153 million. The two also reported at least $7.7 million for at least 39 speeches to big banks, including Goldman Sachs and UBS, with Hillary collecting at least $1.8 million for at least eight speeches to big banks. And these facts are described as a smear, insinuation, and innuendo. There's no innuendo about that. These are just factual statements of her behavior. And somehow she wants to be able to spin it and explain it and get us to accept it. And I have a hint for Team Clinton. It's not working. Meanwhile, the Republicans had their own shit fest on Saturday night, the final debate before the primary election in New Hampshire. And Donald Trump was uncharacteristically kind of subdued. I didn't hear him insult anybody. He wasn't particularly bullying. But Chris Christie more than compensated for that, the big fat governor of New Jersey. Went after Marco Rubio with some very well-targeted information. And he threw Rubio onto his heels. Christie said that Rubio has never been involved in a consequential decision where you had to be held accountable. You just simply haven't. And then he tweaked Rubio, who reverted to a rehearsed, memorized speech attacking Barack Obama. I mean, here he's being assaulted by Chris Christie, and he decides, instead of fighting back, he's going to deflect and talk about Obama. And so here's a quote. He said, "Obama is undertaking a systematic effort to change this country to make America more like the rest of the world. This notion that Barack Obama doesn't know what he's doing just isn't true." And Christie says, "There it is, there it is, the memorized 25-second speech. There it is, everybody." And it's true. He really nailed him. And Chris Christie may not survive after New Hampshire. He's out of money. He's gambling big that he can show up in the top three there and build momentum for the next round. But it's hard to see that he's got what it takes. We'll see what the voters decide on Tuesday. In an orchestrated set of leaks, which may be interpreted as friendly people in the Obama administration trying to take pressure off Hillary Clinton, a front pager on Sunday's New York Times, and it's based entirely on anonymous sources, not a single quote is attributed, they explain that the 22 top secret emails that were on Hillary Clinton's server and now are the source of great contention. Some of them were about CIA drone strikes in Pakistan. And the fact that the Obama administration has decided to keep classified at the top secret level all information related to the drone program has become a political liability for Hillary Clinton. And I actually empathize about this. We have way too much secret information. It's very hard to manage. And the idea that we call secret things that are widely known here and around the world is not only counterproductive, it's just stupid. Several officials said at least one of the emails contained oblique references to CIA operatives. And the Times confirms that the FBI and State Department Security and Intelligence Bureaus continue to investigate issues related to the emails. I mentioned, and you may have heard it on Friday, I was sharply critical of Bernie Sanders for his performance in Thursday night's debate against Hillary Clinton. He didn't respond at all to her claim of innuendo and insinuation and smear campaigns over the money she has taken from Wall Street interests. And he was flat-footed on foreign policy. And I call him like I see him, and our friend, longtime listener, loyal subscriber, Andy Krieger, fired off a note over the weekend. He sent Ben and Jerry, the ice cream moguls from Vermont, who are big supporters of Sanders, a link to my podcast. And I know those guys. I've interviewed them several times. I like them. I love their product. And I confess to them that my love handles are named Ben and Jerry. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. I made one of my trips to the post office box over the weekend. As always, Paul Elsesser from Durham, California, is there with his monthly check. Thank you very much. Robin Gilbert in Southern California sent in a very generous contribution and a renewal of her annual subscription. And so did Tim McCarthy out in Arvada, Colorado. They both more than doubled the amount of money that a subscription costs, and I'm very grateful. And then there's our pal and the vice president for marketing in New England, Del Leonard, who sent me a lengthy note, and I'll respond to it, Del. And he also folded in a little check there. So thanks to each and every one of you. I still need more support. I've got the exciting new giveaway here for new annual subscribers if you sign up. I've got a copy of the F Word, a field manual or field guide. Wait a minute, it's over on the table here. Let me just, yes, a field guide to the F Word by Ben Parker. His podcast is posted, and I think you'll have a lot of fun if you're not too easily offended. And I'd love to send you a copy of his book with your new annual subscription. All the details at peterbcollins.com. Click on the menu tab, then click on Become a Subscriber, and you can take it from there. My thanks to all of you who support my work. Today, I'm releasing to my subscribers an in-depth interview with Bill Black. And Bill Black has formed Bank Whistleblowers United with three other bankers in exile, I guess is the way to put it. And Bill is an amazing guy. I've known him for more than 20 years. He blew the whistle on the savings and loan debacle of the 1980s. He's a federal savings and loan regulator at the time. He helped prosecute criminal bankers and put them in jail. And like many principled people, he is aghast at the failure of the Obama administration to investigate and prosecute the clear crimes that occurred on Wall Street. And he's joined forces with three other whistleblowers, Richard Bowen from Citigroup, who unsuccessfully warned top management about mortgage-backed securities, Michael Winston, who did the same at Countrywide, and Gary Aguirre, a Securities and Exchange Commission attorney who was fired for refusing to let a Wall Street banker out of an insider trading investigation. And these guys have put together a fascinating list of 19 steps, and they're challenging presidential candidates to sign on, to pledge to carry out one or all of these 19 steps that would clean up the corruption in our financial sector without requiring any new laws. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Bill Black.
We don't know, obviously, who will be president or who will control the House and the Senate. So what could we devise through our background that could allow any president who is elected to make foundational, fundamental changes in banking without any new legislation, without any new rulemaking? And by the way, of course, this would allow President Obama to do the same thing in the last year of his term if he were to do so.
Well, he kind of forgot to enforce regulations, even though he touted Mary Jo White, who he appointed to the Securities and Exchange Commission, as a real tough regulator. We haven't seen any results of any serious regulation by the Obama administration. It's all been these huge fines that the banks have paid out of the corporate accounts, but none of the executives has been held responsible.
Yes, and that's what we stress. Indeed, if we want to summarize it really quickly, we say we want to restore the rule of law to Wall Street.
I hope you'll listen to the full interview with bank whistleblower Bill Black. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, at iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, at Spreaker. And if you got the Peter B. Collins app, it's right there on your phone right now. Last week, I interviewed Todd McFarlane. He's a Western rancher, an activist, an attorney who represents the family of Lavoy Finicum. Finicum was at the Malheur Refuge, the wildlife refuge near Burns, Oregon, and he was killed by police and FBI agents in a roadblock. My interview with McFarlane covered the issues of the occupation, the tactics used by the Bundys and their followers, and we looked at the overreaction, in my view, by law enforcement to the standoff and in the killing of Finicum. And I have to say that I've gotten a very strong, sometimes critical response from many of my listeners in Oregon. And first of all, I value your opinion. I'm glad that people have responded, and I don't take it personally when you're critical of my work or my opinions. So let's start with Debbie Kennedy. She's written me several emails, and she's hopping mad. She said, here's a video made by kids going to camp in the Pine Creek area of eastern Oregon. And she mentions that her 12-year-old niece is going there this June. Along with hundreds of other environmentalists, I've worked to pull hundreds of miles of barbed wire fencing from the Pine Creek area. This film brings me almost to tears when I think about you giving a forum for those gun-toting right-wing out-of-staters. We had to fight for the last 30 years to limit cattle on the range. Cows hang around riparian areas and tear them up with their big feet, and the barbed wire fences kill antelope, deer, owls, and other birds. I've picked the carcasses out of the wire myself. After cattle, the stream can no longer serve as a habitat for fish. You should go out there and see it. These assholes didn't just occupy the Malheur Station. They tore up fences in areas where agreements had been worked out over years to stop the fights between the conservationists and the 19th century cowboys. They bulldozed roads in areas that aren't even familiar with because they're from out of state. Bundy's stated goal was to remain at the field station until all federal lands were returned to the people. What people? The Paiute Indians who still live in the area? The kids who like to camp back there? The birders who go out there to look at the birds? The hunters? This is federal land. It belongs to all of us. She says, no, the cows and cowboys don't like us because we pushed and lobbied to get rid of the cows because they're inconsistent with the high desert environment. It really drove me to tears to have you give these guys a forum on your show. That's how angry I was. I have not researched this, but I've heard that the Koch brothers love these guys because they'd like to see federal land opened up to mining. Please don't help these assholes by implying they have valid concerns with the federal government. They don't even live in Oregon. Well, I understand your point of view, Deborah, and I appreciate it. I also heard from Ed Lowe. He said, I don't think I have the stomach to listen to your interview with the lawyer. I have a really bad emotional reaction to this incident, having loved that area forever. I know Oregon Public Broadcasting has been covering this, and I think they would know if there were really dozens of black suburbans with 50 caliber weapons. And that's a statement that is reported by Todd McFarlane in the article that he wrote at BoilingFrogsPost.com. And Ed goes on, the account of the shooting is much like that of the daily encounters of blacks in our communities. He did not have to die, but then he was asking for it. Travesty, Peter. I don't have your calm demeanor, he adds. And then there's a nice note from Rita Sheldrake. Peter, I too was very discouraged and disappointed with your podcast on the group in Harney County. Although I have questions as to why they've added prison time onto their already served time, that's the Hammonds. She then says, I must admit that when you poach and then start fires to cover the evidence, you should deal with the consequences. I almost have the impression that the Bundy group was looking for a cause and apparently came to Oregon threatening, you leave these farmers be or we will deal with you. I question how objective that girl was that you interviewed, and that's not quite accurate. Todd McFarlane quoted his interview with a woman who was a passenger in Lavoie Finicum's truck. And Rita says, if I didn't want to put my life at risk, I wouldn't run a police barricade. All right. These protesters made things very hard for the city of Burns, walking down Main Street brandishing their guns, following and intimidating the citizens, not to speak of the cost to we, the taxpayers in Oregon. They have been asked by the locals to leave. This land has been part of the refuge since 1905, placed there because the land was being overgrazed and going very dry. I guess overall I'm not as anti-government as you seem to be more and more as time goes by. Yes, I do appreciate looking at all sides, and I enjoy your podcast. Signed, Rita. Well, I appreciate that feedback, and I share it so that listeners can understand the range of reactions to my interview with Todd McFarlane. And one other listener, Peter Jacobs, emailed me a link to this commentary from the Daily Astorian. Astoria is a town on the coast of Oregon. And it is not signed. It lists the initials SAF. But it describes the difference between Dave Ward, the sheriff of Harney County, and Glenn Palmer, the sheriff of adjoining Grant County. And he says that Ward of Harney County fought to contain his emotions as he described how the armed occupation had torn the town of Burns apart. And the article reads, while Sheriff Ward was one of the solid, impressive players in this drama, Sheriff Glenn Palmer of adjoining Grant County was at best embarrassing, at worst an enabler of lawbreakers, putting his own county residents at risk. A major motif of the mythology of the West is the sheriff who defends his community from armed invaders. Palmer effectively threw his support to the outsiders, preferring hotheads instead of the rule of law. Unwittingly, it was Palmer's invitation to Ammon Bundy that drew Bundy and his leadership corps to John Day, that's where they were headed, on the fateful afternoon of January 26. The FBI set up a highway roadblock, arresting Bundy and seven others and killing Lavoie Finicum. Prior to the appearance of the occupiers, Sheriff Palmer decided last September that he would write a natural resource management plan for Grant County. The county court, its governing body, reminded Palmer that he had no authority to do so. Then Palmer made sheriff's deputies of a group of 11 citizens to execute the task. Sheriff Palmer exhibited three self-destructive characteristics. As with his baseless attempt to write a county natural resources plan, Palmer acted as though he were a law unto himself. And by intimating that the armed lawbreakers would be welcomed in Grant County, he undercut the sheriff of Harney County. Thirdly, Palmer chose to destabilize the community's security and stability, for which he is responsible. So I'm going to continue to cover this. I may have another conversation with Todd McFarlane as developments occur. And, as always, I welcome your feedback and critical comments here at peterbcollins.com. And finally today, this one's kind of personal. Some great musicians have passed away recently, including Paul Kantner of the Jefferson Airplane and Jefferson Starship, and Dan Hicks, a band leader who fronted the Charlatans a long time ago, then Dan Hicks and the Hot Licks, and then the Acoustic Warriors. Dan passed away of liver cancer Saturday morning at the age of 74. I met Dan Hicks a few times, but he's a very private man, and I knew his wife Claire much better. I know how much she loved Dan, and she's going to miss him in her life. And many of us are going to recall this impish song that he wrote, "How Can I Miss You When You Won't Go Away?" Well, Dan, now it's official. We miss you.
Hey, I talk to your mama, talk to your dad. They say they've tried, but it's all in vain. I'm begging and I'm pleading.
We even got mad.
Now we must face it. You give me a pain.
How can I miss you when you won't go away? I keep telling you day after day.
Just a song, ladies and gentlemen.
But you won't listen. You always stay in
space. Can I miss you when you won't go away?
Well, your never-ending presence really cramps my style. I dream that it won't always be the same. Well, at first I was attracted, but after a while. Have you ever heard of the hard-to-get game?
Oh, oh no.
How can I miss you when you won't go away? Stay and stay.
How can I miss you when you won't go away?